Welcome to Mastering Insolvency and the Debtor-Creditor Relationship. This is one in a series of insolvency collection and bankruptcy podcasts presented by Drinker, Biddle, and Reith. This podcast is not intended to and does not create an attorney-client relationship or attorney-client privilege between Drinker, Biddle, or any of its lawyers and any other person. Although we are lawyers, we do not know the facts of your particular situation and may not know the law of your particular jurisdiction. We do not hold ourselves out as being admitted to practice in any particular jurisdiction, except as described on our website, www.dbr.com. Further, the law is constantly changing and needs to be updated. For an update on the current law and application to your particular facts and circumstances, please contact Andrew Flame at Drinker, Biddle, and Reith at 215-988-2630 or andrew.flame@dbr.com or other qualified and licensed attorney of your choosing. Neither Drinker, Biddle nor its attorneys receive payment nor other compensation from any person or organization related to this podcast. With the lawyer stuff out of the way, let's turn to the exciting world of creditors' rights and insolvency. Welcome back for part two of Oh No, My Customer is Bankrupt, Now What? I'm Andrew Flame, a partner in Drinker, Biddle, and Reith's Bankruptcy and Restructuring Practice Group. I'll be continuing my conversation today with Kristen Going, a partner from our Washington, D.C. office. As you will recall, Kristen is playing the part of the CFO of Alpha Auto Parts, whose important customer, Burning Cash Auto, just recently filed for bankruptcy protection. So, Kristen, I know we've covered a lot in a little bit of time, and it's not easy to digest. Are there any questions you have so far? There are a few more things we definitely need to discuss, but do you have any questions so far?
Well, Andrew, you had mentioned the phrase critical vendor a couple of times, and that really piqued my interest because, of course, we like to think that we are critical to Burning Cash. So that seems like something that would apply to us.
Well, and I agree. And I'll tell you the piece of most interest there, and that is that clip. Because that clip they can't get anywhere else because you own the intellectual property and you own the tooling.
That's right.
So, and it's necessary to paint every one of their vehicles. If they don't have an alternative, they're kind of stuck and their production line shuts down. That's kind of my understanding.
That's right.
Okay. So let's talk about critical vendor. And we refer to this as critical vendor payments. I told you that the debtor can't pay you for what's owed to you pre-bankruptcy without court approval, right? And you, if they do, that can be taken away from you later. It can be recovered by the debtor's bankruptcy estate, okay? But there's this concept that's developed in bankruptcy that called critical vendor, and it's a court-approved exception to that general rule. And the idea is this, that a debtor should be able to pay a vendor or a creditor that is necessary for the debtor to continue its operations or to continue efficiently its operations to the extent necessary to get supply those critical goods or services.
Well, it certainly seems like we would fall into that definition based on the fact that our special clip is something that is crucial to Burning Cash being able to paint all of the vehicles that they create, and they can't get that clip from anyone but ourselves.
And that's right. Now, we want to be a little careful here. There's a difference between being a vendor that's critical to their operations and meeting the definition of a vendor that may be able to get payment as a critical vendor. And the difference is, while you may be critical to their operation, do they have to pay you something to get you to continue supplying them? Now, remember, two things we talked about. I'll review your contract later, but what you've told me is your contract says you're obligated to supply them. All right? So you're contractually obligated to continue providing them goods. So theoretically, assuming you wouldn't do something unlawful, like violating the stay or otherwise refusing to ship to them, they shouldn't have to pay you anything on your pre-bankruptcy claim in order to have you continue to supply them post-bankruptcy. And you may want to continue providing them post-bankruptcy irrespective, because you still may be making a profit. Even if you have some loss, you may be making a profit post-bankruptcy as long as they're able to pay you. So they, like I said before, there may be a better credit risk. But so what I just said, and I want to emphasize this, is while theoretically they shouldn't pay you as a critical vendor because you're contractually obligated to continue supplying them during the bankruptcy case, the reality is that creditors owed money that are obligated to continue to provide goods and services get critical vendor payments all the time. So it never hurts to ask.
Well, I do think that the client contact that I spoke to yesterday mentioned something about a critical vendor. How would I find out whether or not Burning Cash is treating us as a critical vendor?
Well, that's going to be a discussion at the business level. Let me tell you how the process generally works, because one thing you can find out is who's on the list. Okay? Typically, that is something that if it's even filed with the court, it's filed, what lawyers call, it's filed under seal. It's filed privately so that other than certain parties and the judge, no one gets to see the list. And that makes sense, right? Because if you know you're on the list, I mean, even if you're on the list for a particular amount, the debtor has no negotiating power. So this allows the debtor to not pay certain vendors because they don't ask, or to negotiate how much they're going to pay. But let me tell you how the process generally works. In the opening days of the case, it's not uncommon for a debtor to file a motion to approve payments to vendors they consider to be critical, okay, critical vendors. And that motion either won't have a list or the list will be filed under seal, but the aggregate amount of those critical vendor payments, so the approval to pay up to $5 million, $7 million, whatever, $250,000, depending on the size of the company, will be in the motion. And that's what the judge approves. So the aggregate amount is set, but not necessarily the amount to be paid to a particular critical vendor. So again, if you don't ask, you don't get paid, and it's all part of the negotiation if they're willing to pay you as a critical vendor, how much of your pre-bankruptcy receivable actually gets paid. It's not always all of it. Usually the debtor would negotiate to pay some portion of it. And remember, whatever you get is 100 cent dollars paid now, as opposed to getting payment a year, 2 years, or even longer down the road in what very well and usually is less than 100 cent dollars. So it's really good to be on the critical vendor list and to ask and to have that discussion about the importance of the relationship.
So can I call them and ask if Alpha Auto Parts is going to be treated as a critical vendor? You've made me a little concerned right now that the automatic stay means I can't contact Burning Cash at all.
Well, you can have a discussion with them regarding getting payments to the extent approved by the bankruptcy court. So this is an exception to the rule. What you can't do is go to them and say, if you don't pay me, I'm not shipping you anything. Okay. But what you can have is a discussion about, and we'll look to make sure whether they filed a motion for a critical vendor. Even if they didn't, you can ask if they're going to and say you would like to be on that list. This is a large receivable. We'll talk more about the rationale for that discussion. And as you start having the discussions, we'll follow up before you have the next discussion. But the key is that this would be a court-approved payment. We would want to look at the order that the judge enters and make sure it complies, the payment coming to you complies with that order. The other thing that debtors require, and I haven't seen a critical payment yet that doesn't require this, and they're going to require you to sign an agreement with the debtors. And this is important. That agreement is going to say, and it will want, there may be things we negotiate, but the basic parts of it are, we will pay you $1 million of your pre-petition amount. That will reduce your claim in the case. You are obligated, you're agreeing to continue to supply us clips and switches during the bankruptcy case. And also it's going to say that you supply them on the most favorable terms you offered the debtor pre-bankruptcy within some period of time, within the year before or the 6 months before. So one of the things we have to discuss and we have to make sure you're comfortable with is the terms under which you're going to be obligated to provide your goods to them and that time frame. And those things we may be able to negotiate a little bit, limiting the time frame, setting up maybe new credit terms in terms of how long they have to pay, if the debtor will agree, and if the court gives them in the order the flexibility to do that. So you're committing to do things, and we want to evaluate the credit risk with the debtor. That's part of what money's available. And what your risk is, that is in comparison to the benefit of getting 100 cent dollars on some portion or all of your pre-petition claim.
One of the things that you just said was that this critical vendor payment would reduce my claim in the case. Obviously, since they're not paying me right now, I don't like the idea that I'm reducing anything. So what did you mean by that?
Sure. So if you're a $2.1 million today.
That's right.
The critical vendor payment would be a payment against that $2.1 million receivable for you, payable for them.
Well, that's good news.
Right. And you're getting 100 cent dollars. So instead of being owed $2.1 million, you'd be owed, after the payment, you'd be owed $1.1 million. And one of the things we're going to do, we need to talk about also, is what claims you would have in the case. And that's all going to be impacted by how much you get paid and the terms of that agreement and how it says that payment is to be applied.
And what do you mean by claim?
Sure. So as a creditor owed money, either pre-bankruptcy or post-bankruptcy, you have a claim. It's just like you say you have a claim in a lawsuit. You have a claim to that you're owed a certain amount of money, and you assert that you're entitled to be paid. In bankruptcy, the term claim is very, very broad. So we want to think about in preparing what lawyers call a proof of claim, which is something you file in the case to say, here's what I'm owed pre-bankruptcy, and I'm entitled to receive distribution, I'm entitled to receive payment in the bankruptcy case as a creditor. In forming that proof of claim and drafting it, we want to think about, are there indemnification obligations that are out there so that we can include those amounts that have been paid or might be owed in the future in your proof of claim? Are there, in addition to your receivables, are there any other, I'll say, lingering obligations of the debtor to you? If we don't assert them in the proof of claim, then you don't get to share in a distribution to the extent they weren't asserted.
So you're saying I won't get paid if I don't put them in the claim?
Other than if you get paid through a critical vendor motion, and except for your post-bankruptcy. This proof of claim deals mostly with, really deals with pre-bankruptcy unless the court orders otherwise. You won't get paid unless you file a proof of claim. The exception is in a Chapter 11, like this case, the debtor will file schedules saying who all their creditors are. Has other information too. If you're listed in there for the correct amount and essentially that they don't dispute your owed it, okay, or the amount, then you would get a distribution. I will tell you, good practice is, even if you're listed, to file a proof of claim. Because if the case later craters and converts to a liquidation in Chapter 7, you have a limited time to file a proof of claim. And those schedules, those bankruptcy schedules that you were listed in, are not any longer relevant. So good practice is to file the proof of claim with your backup documentation, and there's a time in which to do that. Even if you're listed in a Chapter 11. The proof of claim, there are certain time frames to file a proof of claim for the pre-petition amounts owed. In a Chapter 11 case, the debtor will actually file a motion with the court to get the date set and will then send notice out to all its creditors. Okay, that date, whether in a Chapter 11 or a Chapter 7 liquidation, that date should be the subject of a notice that you receive. However, if you don't get the notice but you know about the bankruptcy case, you're going to have a difficult time filing late. And if you don't file by the date that's required, you don't get to share in any distributions in the bankruptcy estate. So it's a very important date. We call it the bar date. It bars claims after that date. That's, I think, the origin of the name bar date. But it's a for lawyers, it's like a statute of limitations, right? If you have a claim and your time to sue ends because the time ran, same thing with a bar date. You don't have anything left afterwards in terms of sharing in the distribution. So we want to make sure we file the proof of claim. Frankly, there's not really a reason to wait until they issue the notice of the new, of the date. We can file it now, or we can file it, prepare it, let you review it, and get it organized and filed sooner rather than later so that we don't miss that bar date.
And what would you need in order to prepare this proof of claim?
It's really pretty simple. And that is, we'll have to figure out the amount you're owed. If it's all unsecured, right? If you're holding, does Alpha hold a deposit from the debtor?
No, we don't.
Okay. Do you have any type of collateral, anything securing their payment to you from which you could look to get paid if they don't pay you?
Unfortunately, no.
Okay. So you have an unsecured claim. If you had a deposit or you had a lien on assets, we would file it potentially as a secured claim in whole or in part, figure out how much it is. But with an unsecured claim, so what we're going to do is we're going to prepare a form, bankruptcy form, that has some information and how much you're owed, and then we're going to attach the documents that support that. So we're going to typically attach the contract, the master agreement that you told me about, as well as if there are purchase orders for outstanding invoices, for goods supplied under outstanding invoices, copies of those invoices, and if there are any volume, my recommendation is we prepare an Excel spreadsheet with a summary of the invoice information and the amount owed. One other thing in following a proof of claim, if there's confidential pricing information, are there confidential information in your documents? Well, I want to make sure you identify that if that's the case, and we can redact it from the public filing, and we'll say right in our proof of claim, we usually put a statement behind it describing how our claim arose. We'll say right in there that we've redacted confidential business information.
That's important to know. So this proof of claim becomes a public record?
As a general matter, it does. There's usually, in large cases, there'll be something called a claims agent a lot of times. It's appointed by the court. And that notice that says, here's your bar date, it will also tell you how to file and where to send the proof of claim. We'll do it for you. You'll sign it, send us, and we'll get it where it has to go. But it's either filed with the court or with somebody else pursuant to that order and notice. If it's filed with the court, it's generally a public document. Anybody can view it. With the claims agent, sometimes, a lot of times it's accessible now through the internet publicly. Sometimes they're not, which frankly can be difficult for lawyers later on when we're trying to do things and find things that have been filed. But from your perspective, that may be beneficial. But either way, we want to make sure that we're not sharing proprietary confidential information if pricing is sensitive and so forth. For example, the switches, you told me there's other suppliers.
That's right.
So we may not want them to be able to see what we're charging burning cash for the switches, because that'll give them an idea in bidding other work.
It sounds like, from what you've been telling me, that there are about basically three different ways in which we could get paid. One is through a critical vendor status, if the debtor chooses to designate us as a critical vendor. The other is the proof of claim that we were just talking about. And then earlier we were talking about the assumption of our contract, which would also then provide for the debtor to pay us. Are there any other ways in which we could get paid the money that we're owed by burning cash auto?
Well, there's two other things that would apply to you because you're providing goods, the clips and the switches, to burning cash. And they're called reclamation, which either can get you an elevated claim, and we'll say a higher priority claim, or your goods back. That's reclamation. And the other is, I'm going to use bankruptcy speak, because this is how it's referenced, what's called a 503B9 claim. It's actually the section of the bankruptcy code. And that's for goods delivered within the 20 days before the bankruptcy. So I'm going to start with what the 503B9 claim is. okay?
We and did then, actually send them a significant amount of goods, and I think it was within the last 20 days.
So there's two time frames, and that's really helpful because the goods that they received, as opposed to you shipped, and we'll talk about that briefly, but the goods that the debtor received, excuse me, within 20 days can be subject to a 503b9 claim, which is a post-bankruptcy administrative claim. It doesn't get paid in the ordinary course, but it gets paid as an administrative claim when they confirm a Chapter 11 plan and the plan becomes effective. But let's talk about first 503b9, okay? Because that's the shorter time frame. So under the bankruptcy code, the creditor that delivers goods to the debtor within 20 days of bankruptcy is entitled to an administrative expense priority claim. And we talked about this in the context of goods that you ship post-bankruptcy, remember? And that in that case, they should be paying you in the ordinary course. And if the music stops, you would get paid as an unsecured creditor ahead of pre-petition under unsecured creditors. Okay, remember we talked about that before?
I do.
Okay. This works the same way, except you wouldn't get paid during the case. You would get paid when a plan's confirmed or there was a distribution later in the case. And you get that priority. So if there's money to pay unsecured creditors, you get paid as an administrative expense priority before pre-petition unsecured creditors.
Does that mean that we would get paid more than unsecured creditors?
You get paid more than unsecured creditors holding a pre-petition claim. So let's take, for example, your $2.1 million, okay? If $1 million of that was delivered in the 20 days before bankruptcy and a Chapter 11 plan is confirmed and goes effective, you'll get paid the $1 million unless you agree otherwise on the day that plan goes effective or shortly thereafter. The rest of your $1.1 million will be a general unsecured claim and will get whatever the plan provides for you to receive. It could be, remember we talked about unsecured, it could be a nickel, a dime, or 90 cents. We don't know yet because we don't know anything about the debtor's financial status and what the plan will look like. But that's the difference between the administrative claim that you get for goods delivered within the 20 days as compared to your general pre-petition claim for things that are longer. Okay. And the good news is for 503b9 claim for those goods delivered in 20 days, all you have to prove is that the debtor received the goods within the 20 days and that the goods were purchased by the debtor or received by the debtor in the ordinary course of the debtor's business. Okay. We're going to talk about reclamation, and there's a lot of other issues tied to reclamation, even though the period is longer. But the 503b9, usually the fight is over when were the goods received.
This seems like a very important tool for us. What would I need to provide you in order to make a 503b9 claim?
So the things we would need is the same type of information we would need for the proof of claim. The contract, open invoices, copies of the open invoices, a summary. And this is all for goods received in the 20 days.
Right.
Okay. The same information, but limited to that 20-day goods received in the 20 days.
And then you take that information and you file something with the court?
Yes. Yeah, so, and the court will enter, and we're going to talk about reclamation too, but in larger cases, it is essentially routine that the debtor is asking for and the court's entering these procedures order that says, here's how you file it, here's who has to receive it, here's the process by which your claim will get reconciled. The debtor will review it. The debtor will say if they have objections and why, and you try to resolve it. And if not, then you go to a hearing to determine whether you have any 503b9 or reclamation claim or what portion should be allowed under the law in terms of you met the requirements. So why don't we talk a moment about reclamation. And reclamation is longer period. It's a 45-day pre-bankruptcy period compared to the 20 days for the administrative 503b9 claim. What? So what is reclamation? Okay, if a debtor is insolvent, or a company is non-bankruptcy too, a company is insolvent, you can demand return of all goods you deliver to them within 45 days of the date you make the demand. Now, in bankruptcy, you get extra 20 days, and that 45 days, you can 20 days to make the demand, and the 45 days look back runs from the bankruptcy date. Okay, does that make sense?
This something that I would? Can I just call up Burning Cash and say that this is hereby a demand for return of the goods?
No, unfortunately, it's not quite that simple. We have to make the demand in writing. Certain information has to be included. It's going to look a lot like the information from the proof of claim, except it's typically not the contract. It would be the bills of lading showing what was delivered, the invoices showing the value. Now, the question you have to ask here is, do you want all the goods back? Or
right.
Do you want some subset of the goods back? Or do you want none of the goods back?
Well, I was just thinking the same thing. I would imagine that we would probably want the switches back because we could turn around and sell those to another automobile company that was actually paying us and not filed bankruptcy. But those special switches, we wouldn't really want them back because we don't have anyone else to sell them to.
So, Kristen, there's two other requirements for reclamation. We should talk about those. And those are that the goods must be identifiable. They can't be commingled with other goods. So, for example, if you and I both sell sand to a debtor, and when your truck backs up and that dump truck dumps 2 tons of sand on top of the sand that I previously delivered, you can't tell the difference between your sand and my sand. And therefore, they're commingled, and they're not identifiable and not subject to reclamation.
That makes sense.
Okay. So the question becomes, how do you identify goods that look almost identical? If they're identical, commingling becomes an issue. So I'm going to use your switches, right? You've told me there's other suppliers for the switches, and the debtor, I think you said, buys switches from other suppliers.
That's right.
So the switch is going to be dimension-wise and operationally the same, and it may look essentially identical to the switches you're selling the debtor. Do you mark your switches with any special markings, part numbers, lot numbers?
We do, in fact. Each one of our switches has a lot number that is marked on the back of it.
So you could identify your switch versus my switch or your competitor's switch by physically looking at it.
Absolutely.
And you said it's a lot number. Is the lot number assigned based on manufacture date or that you could identify?
Yes.
So could you identify which lot was delivered within the 20 days?
We certainly can. We keep a record of that.
Okay. So that works for both the 503B9, but more importantly, the reclamation claim. Because now you can identify your goods separate from the goods of your competitor, the switches, I should say, of your competitor. Even though they look mostly alike, they're unique markings. So you can get over that hurdle. The other thing that can inhibit a reclamation claim is the goods you delivered must not have been consumed or incorporated into finished goods, in this case the cars that the debtor's making, before you make your demand. So I don't know how much inventory the debtor's carrying. If they increased their purchases, they may have increased them in anticipation of bankruptcy and therefore carrying heavier inventory. You may have an idea because you've dealt with the debtor and sold these goods to the debtor for at least several years, what their turnover rate is or has been recently.
That's right. I think that they tend to have a lot of inventory. And I think what you're saying is if our switches are basically just sitting on a shelf somewhere, then we would have a good claim. But if they're actually already on a car, would that defeat our claim?
So if they're incorporated into the car, you can't go and disassemble the car to give all the vendors back their parts.
That makes sense.
So if it hasn't been consumed consumed or used in production by the time that your demand is made, it is subject to a good reclamation claim. And if they use it later, they're going to have to give you a priority admin claim as part of that.
That all makes sense.
So we have those two pieces, reclamation and 503b9 claims. They can elevate your claim, but we want to decide if you actually want to demand return. So we should talk more about that as you get more information. So, Kristen, if you don't have any more questions about reclamation and 503b9 claims, there's two other areas I'd like to cover. And the first one is whether you'd have an interest in serving on what's called a creditor's committee. Is it okay if I move on to that at this point?
Sure, I'd like to learn about that.
All right. So as a general matter, unsecured creditors in a case don't have a lot of skin in the game. Either they're not owed a lot of money to begin with, because unsecured creditors include somebody who sweeps the floor, bad choice, but we'll go with that. Somebody who sweeps the floor or somebody who supplies the brooms, okay? And they don't have a lot of money at stake, so it's not likely they're going to hire an attorney to show up in court and protect their interests. In addition, they may not get 100 cents on a relatively small claim. So even a claim that's larger may only have a real value that's relatively small.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're basically saying that because unsecured creditors aren't likely to receive 100 cents of what they're owed, they're not likely to participate actively in the case.
That's true to some extent. Larger creditors, you have a lot at stake.
That's right.
And you have some ways of getting paid earlier. So we can be more active in this case individually. But if it's a very small distribution, if it's a penny or two pennies in the end, even a large claim has very little value to the creditor in the end. And we don't know what it's worth at the beginning of the case. So unsecured creditors, in some cases, are loath to incur a lot of expense, including legal fees and so forth, to further their position and fight for their position in the case and their distribution. So a committee is provided for in the bankruptcy code from which the interests of those unsecured creditors as a body are protected.
And this committee protects the interests of all unsecured creditors?
Correct. It's intended to protect the interests and better the distribution and have influence in the case on behalf of all unsecured creditors, not any one member of the committee. Now, you as an individual creditor, separate from the committee, through me as your counsel, can take whatever action we feel we need to protect your individual rights. But you can't use your seat on the committee, if you decide to serve, to further your individual rights and claims. And if you have a conflict, you would recluse yourself from the decision the committee has to make. So we can still act in your best interests separately, and you could serve on the committee. Now, what's the benefits? There are really very few costs other than your opportunity costs, and expenses out of pocket get administrative expense priority, and we've talked about what that is. You can apply for that. The benefit is, one, you're active in the case. You know what's happening, which helps you make decisions on your individual claims. You have to keep information confidential, but you're going to be in the know. It also gives you the opportunity as a large creditor and a member of the committee, to influence what's happening in the case. The creditors committee plays an important role, and as a general matter, judges recognize that important role. The creditors committee, through its counsel, appears and can be heard on everything that happens in the case and can express their opinion. Can object if the debtor's doing something they think isn't right, can oppose a plan. After a certain period of time, can propose their own plan. So the committee plays an important role and really pushes for the interests of the unsecured creditors. And depending how the case unfolds and whether they feel the debtor is doing what the debtor should be doing and that the unsecured creditors are getting a fair shake, the unsecured creditors can shape the result of the case in the end. So it's for a creditor with a real claim where we think there may be a real distribution, and I can't speak to that yet. I have to look at what's on the docket, and I'll do that. But there's an opportunity to do that. And this committee is formed early in the case. The top creditors, the top 20 or 30 creditors, typically will get a notice from the U.S. Trustee's office
And do you mean top creditors by size of the claim?
By size of claim. We'll typically get contacted by the United States Trustee's Office, which is part of the Department of Justice. It's the governmental office that monitors bankruptcy cases and participates in bankruptcy cases, inviting you to apply to be on the committee, or inviting those 20 or 30 largest creditors. If you're not on that list, you still can contact, we can still, I'll do it for you, contact the U.S. Trustee's Office if you're interested in serving and express our interest into why you should serve. So, and that committee is formed at an organizational meeting that usually happens within a couple of 3 weeks or so of the beginning of the case. So I don't know if you have interest. Do you want to think about that? And we'll
it does sound like an important committee, and I think it would be beneficial to be able to have a voice in Burning Cash's bankruptcy.
Okay, so let me look at what's on the docket, make sure the meeting hasn't been scheduled. And then we'll go back and make sure I'll get the form from the office of the U.S. trustee, prepare that, and then we'll talk some more, and I'll start contacting them by voice over the phone or in writing to lobby on your behalf.
That sounds great.
So, Kristen, the last thing I'd like to cover, and I only want to cover it briefly because we don't really have to address it now, but it's you need to understand what this is, and we need to make sure we retain records related to it. And that is something called a preference. And I don't want to alarm you with this, but under the bankruptcy code, there is a claim that arises upon the filing of a bankruptcy case to recover money paid by the debtor to creditors for an existing obligation. And if those payments are made, or there's other transfer of property or a lien given on an existing debt, that and the transfer of payments within 90 days of the bankruptcy filing, it may be recoverable by the debtor's bankruptcy estate. Now, there are certain defenses, but let me tell you first what a preference is.
Wait a minute. It sounds like you're telling me that I might have to give back money that the debtor's paid to me within the last 90 days. That can't possibly be the case.
Well, unfortunately, it is. From the perspective of a creditor that got paid in the 90 days, it is a poison pill to swallow when you've already out $2.1 million in your case, and then payments that you received in the 90 days may also be subject to being what we call disgorged or paid back. Now, do you have an idea approximately how much was paid in the 90 days before the bankruptcy that you received?
I think it was about $1.5 million.
Okay. So again, I don't want you to get alarmed. There are defenses, and we can go into them later. But let me tell you generally what a preference is. And then we should talk about keeping your records and make sure you preserve your records, because to assert the defenses, it's going to be our burden to prove them.
What kind of records do I need to preserve?
So you should keep anything related to the debtor's account, all the historic payment information, obviously copies of the contracts, copies of the invoices, copies of bills of lading, copies of any records, electronic or paper records that you have. They should be preserved.
Are these records just for that 90-day period?
No. Some of our defenses may require us to look at historic period, going back before the 90 days. So my recommendation is that you keep whatever records you have. Make sure that your electronic records are backed up. So if you change systems, accounting systems and record systems, they don't get lost. And make sure that the paper records also are kept so that any document retention policy doesn't result in destruction of any type of records. You should, because we're going to need those records to prove your defenses. There's not a lot the debtor needs to prove, and they should be able to do it from their bank records for the most part. So we need your records to prove various defenses. And we don't have to get into the defenses today. I'll tell you, based on the amount of your claims, some of the things you've told me about them increasing purchases in the last 2 months, it's likely you're going to have a number of defenses, but we can analyze that when I get the data from you. But let me tell you what a preference is so you understand what it is to begin with and generally the purpose. I think for today, you've heard a lot. That'll be enough. So a preference in bankruptcy terms is a payment within 90 days a payment or a granting of a lien or other transfer of an interest in property of the debtor that is made within 90 days of the bankruptcy filing on an existing obligation of the debtor to you. So in this case, you sold them on credit. Outstanding invoices is a pre-existing obligation with they pay you on that invoice on credit terms, okay? And if you've received more than you would have in a Chapter 7 case that's liquidating the debtor's assets as a result of that payment, then under the statute, it's recoverable. Now, there's no intent, despite the name preference, that the debtor actually prefer you as a creditor, that the debtor make a conscious decision that it's going to pay Alpha and not Flame Co., all right? And this is also what we call a strict liability type of claim as in lawyer speak, and that means that it's not that you did anything wrong. It's simply the facts exist that make you liable.
So you're
not
saying,
merely that you did anything wrong in getting paid.
So you're saying just by virtue of receiving the money within 90 days that I may have to give it back?
Subject to your defenses, that's correct. So let me tell you the purpose. The purpose is that a creditor that gets paid within 90 days gets 100 cents on whatever's paid, where other creditors that didn't receive that get, in the bankruptcy case, usually some portion of 100 cents. It could be a penny, a nickel, a dime, or 90 cents. And the idea is to bring that money back such that creditors that got paid don't get a windfall compared to these other creditors, to give you a claim in the case, which you then share in the redistribution of that money amongst all of the unsecured creditors. Now, that's not to say that you're happy about that, because a claim isn't worth usually the money you have to pay back. And in fact, if it's a 100-cent case, there will be no preference claims brought. But that's the purpose. And I know, again, I understand that, it's kind of getting hit twice. $2.1 million that you didn't get paid, hopefully, which we'll recover in other ways like we talked about, at least to some extent. And then on top of that, another $1.5 million. I recognize that, and I know that's tough to swallow, but that's how the law is, whether we like it or not. So we'll talk more about the defenses, but for now, what's most important is preserve your records, okay? And what we should revisit shortly is whether you believe and your accountants believe you need to reserve for any type of possible liability back to the bankruptcy estate under this preference cause of action.
Well, I certainly recognize that this could be an additional liability, and I appreciate you bringing it to my attention now so that we're able to preserve the records that you may need down the line if we do have to defend a preference claim.
So, Kristen, the one thing I want to make sure you understand is that you always want to try to get payment. You want to use good credit practices and collection practices and not worry about preference, because you want to get paid, okay? And the sooner you get paid, hopefully that 90 days runs before there's any bankruptcy filing, if there is one. I just want to make sure we understand. I'm not saying don't use your best collection practices. We have a saying, in addition, by the way, usually you don't pay back 100% of what they claim is owed. We're able to resolve it for something less. So you do get more than you otherwise would have. But with all that said, we have a saying in bankruptcy that real men or real women take preferences and wimps file proofs of claim. Meaning, go collect your money, have it in your hands, and make somebody claw it out of your cold, dead hands, as opposed to having to file a proof of claim against some small percentage of what you're owed. All right?
That makes sense. I certainly, would rather take the risk of potentially having somebody come back after me for money down the line rather than sit by the sidelines and not get the money in the first instance.
So we've covered a lot today, Kristen, and I know that. I'll send you an email with the information that we talked about you're providing to me. And if you don't have any other questions, try to digest this. Think if you have other questions later on, and we can talk in the next few days.
Thank you, Andrew.
Join us for our future podcasts, including our next podcast, Keep What You've Earned, Bankruptcy Preference Actions and Your Defenses. For individual legal advice, please contact Andrew Flame, Corporate Restructuring Partner at Drinker, Biddle & Reith at 215-988-2630 or andrew.flame@dbr.com. This podcast and its content is copyright 2016 Drinker, Biddle & Reith LLP, all rights reserved. This podcast may not be copied, modified, or otherwise used in whole or in part without the prior written permission of Drinker, Biddle & Reith LLP.